On this week's 51%, we chat about the new rules of women's health with veteran health journalist Megan Rabbit.
We have been compared to the male quote unquote norm. You know, there were so many assumptions made when it came to research that we could just apply what we learned in men in the male body to women. And what we now know is that that's ludicrous.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us, I'm Jesse King. A couple years ago on this show, we spoke with the author of All in Her Head about the various ways sexism and misogyny in early medicine shaped women's health care today. It's no secret that the diseases and health issues women face, like endometriosis, don't receive the same level of funding as diseases that primarily impact men. More than that, though, scientists have long treated the male body as the default of sorts, with this notion that the female body is largely similar, except for having breasts and different reproductive organs. Well, our guest today argues that women's health encompasses more than just breasts and vaginas, and she set out to make a guide to help women learn about their unique needs across the board. Megan Rabbit is an award-winning health journalist whose work has been featured in Women's Health, Oprah Daily, Parenting, NPR, Maria Shriver's Sunday Paper, and more. Her new guide, called The New Rules of Women's Health, compiles the knowledge she's learned from more than 130 doctors and medical experts, from gynecologists and breast cancer specialists to cardiologists and internists. Rabbit says women will sometimes react differently to diseases than men will, and the health advice we receive should not always be the same. The New Rules of Women's Health is designed to be an all-encompassing guide of what the field currently knows to help women address their concerns at every age.
Maria Shriver asked me to write this book for her imprint at Penguin Random House. So I set out to write this book with that assignment from Maria Shriver. And she said, Megan, you've been covering health for your entire career. We don't have a really comprehensive women's health book right now. You know, the women's health books that we do have that feel comprehensive really focus on what we now refer to as bikini medicine. It's our reproductive organs and our sexual health and our breast health. And these are really important aspects of health. But we know more now about women's hearts and our brains, and starting to learn a little bit more about the female immune system. And so she really tasked me with putting together a book that covered really specialties and what we know about women specifically in those areas, in addition to the reproductive organs and our sexual health, et cetera. And so that's how the book came to be. And I really got to reporting then and took a bird's eye view and just said, what needs to be in this book? Who do I need to talk to? Then what followed was the 3-year process of reporting, writing, revising, fact-checking, et cetera.
I don't think I've ever heard of the term bikini medicine before, but I like it. It makes sense. You know, and to be fully honest, a lot of the medical discussions we've had on this show have centered around breast health and the reproductive system. But, you know, I do agree. There's this idea that kind of like outside that realm, that women's health is just the same as men's health.
Yeah, and we have been compared to the male quote unquote norm. You know, there were so many assumptions made when it came to research that we could just apply what we learned in men in the male body to women. And what we now know is that that's ludicrous, right?
So when you say some diseases show up differently in women than men, which diseases are you talking about? Give me some examples.
I would love to highlight a few. So let's start with heart health. And really what we are now learning is that heart disease in women looks different than it does in men, and symptoms of heart attack look different in women than it does in men. I think we are finally starting to talk about this, which is great. The tricky part about it for women is that women's heart attack symptoms can look a lot more subtle than they do in men. If you Google heart attack, and then you click the little images button in your search results, what you typically see is men and they're grabbing their chest, they're grabbing their arm. It is that, you know, my elephant sitting on my chest pain. Mm-hmm. Whereas with women, it might be a feeling of being just extra tired or a little bit nauseated consistently. Just a feeling that something's not right. And unfortunately, what happens, there's data to prove this, is that when women go to the emergency room with symptoms of a heart attack, the more subtle symptoms that can show up in women, they can be turned away, whereas men get treatment right away. And so this is something for women to really be aware of, because when we know that, we can push for care, right? The care that we deserve. I think something else too that we are learning is that the female brain undergoes a lot of changes after the menopause transition. And we're starting to understand that this might be why women are two-thirds the cases of Alzheimer's disease. I think that statistic still shocks a lot of women, and we're just not aware of that. And I think, unfortunately, that's a problem, because what we now know about Alzheimer's disease is that actually it's a disease that starts years before symptoms actually show up. And so if, as women, we know we're disproportionately at risk for Alzheimer's disease, we can start to take some of the steps earlier, some of those lifestyle steps like exercise and eating well. We can make changes now to help prevent that being our fate later on.
That's interesting. We've done a few episodes centered around menopause. What kinds of changes, I guess, are happening in the brain during this time?
Yeah, so we are thankfully starting to do research into the female brain, and specifically, Dr. Lisa Moscone is doing groundbreaking research on understanding what happens with estrogen receptors in the brain. And so, as we know, in menopause, estrogen goes down. And Dr. Moscone's recent work, it's been very recent, that she has found that actually the brain in menopause starts sprouting more estrogen receptors to try to just soak up as much estrogen as we still make. And so, what that point too is that, of course, that dip in estrogen during this major hormonal transition that is menopause may have an impact on our brain health.
Well, your book is called The New Rules of Women's Health. I guess, what are they, and how are they different from the old rules?
There are new rules throughout every chapter of the book. So I start with anatomy, go into puberty, sexual health, a lot of what we call bikini medicine, right? Our gynecologic health, our breast health, and then into the specialties and beyond. And I think if I'm going to look at it overall, the first new rule is that we really have to own our health. We are living in a time where doctor's visits are shorter than ever. There's not a lot of continuity of care, right? My mom saw the same primary care physician for decades. That's not going to be what happens for me. And so when it comes to owning our healthcare, Maria has said, and I love this, that we all have to become the CEO of our own healthcare. And when you think about what does a CEO do, they educate themselves so that they feel really informed going into any meeting. And I think that for women, that means understanding what we know about sex-specific differences in health. What do I need to know as a woman that's different than what the men in my life need to know? Education is key. CEOs also hire the right team. They look for the best, and then they hire those people. And for us, I think that means if we have the capability of doing this, finding the right doctors, finding doctors and other clinicians and healthcare practitioners who feel like, who we feel confident seeing, who feel like the team we want in place to help us care for ourselves. And I think also, as part of that as well, CEOs show up prepared, and we need to go to our healthcare providers prepared. And I interviewed a doctor who said, you'd never show up to your accountant, your for a tax appointment without coming with your binder of information and documents and reconciling your books if you own your own business. And the same is true for us when it comes to our doctor visits. We need to come with our personal health history, our family health history, a list of symptoms. I had interviewed a doctor who said, not only do I want to see your list of symptoms, but in an ideal world, you'd prioritize that list in order that you think is most important so that you can help us optimize the short visit. Because I wish I had more time with you as well, but the fact is that we probably only have like 20 minutes. And so that's a big rule. That's how we own our health. I think another big rule that I feel passionate about more women understanding is pain is not acceptable anymore. I think generations before us, as women, we tend to tough it out. We tend to be told, ugh, it's just a bummer of being a woman. Buck up, buttercup. You're fine. You got this. And no more. I interviewed Dr. Vonda Wright, who told me, she's an orthopedic surgeon who says that when she is at the bedside of patients, it's women who wear their pain as a badge of honor. And the unfortunate part about that is that when we don't get treated for our pain gets worse. And so I think that's a new rule. It's like, come to your doctor with your symptoms. They've seen everything, they've heard everything. Don't suffer. You don't have to suffer. One more new rule that I feel passionate about, because again, it was a trend of what I heard from all the clinicians and I interviewed and researchers, is that women still feel a lot of shame around our bodies. You know, we apologize for our biology. We apologize for not shaving our armpits or bikini line. I interviewed a urologist, Dr. Maria Uloko, who hands women a hand mirror when she does vulvar exams. And she says more than half of her patients don't want to look. And that's shame. And I think it's time for us to do what we can to try to drop that and talk to each other about what we're going through, talk to our doctors what we're going through to get the care we really deserve.
You said you spent about 3 years working on this book, but you have a long career in writing about women's health. Was there anything in your research that really surprised you?
Yeah. When I tucked into the breast health chapter, what I learned really shocked me, which is that most women think that they're, you know, once we turn 40, if there's no family history of breast cancer, we get a mammogram and we consider ourselves on it when it comes to breast cancer prevention. I know that's what happened to me. But then I did a bunch of interviews and learned that actually, what most doctors are not talking to us proactively about is our lifetime risk of breast cancer. And this is really important. And it's something that when we know what our lifetime risk of breast cancer is, and we can have that conversation with our doctors, it can really set a trajectory for breast cancer screening. That's crucial. So this is one example of it is the Tyrer-Cuzick model, which everyone can take online at home, bring the results to your doctor and say, hey, these are my results from the Tyrer-Cuzick model, which I t quiz that I took at home. Can we talk about them? Can we talk about my lifetime risk of breast cancer and my breast cancer screening plan to come up with the right plan for me? And that really surprised me because I thought, wow, I'm a health journalist and I go regular doctor's visits, and I have never had a doctor talk to me proactively about that. Sure enough, this year I brought that up with my gynecologist, and it ended up in me having a breast MRI. And so it just points to the more we have this information, the more we can really own our health and be really proactive when it comes to our care.
You know, one thing that I just wanted to ask, I'm seeing a lot of talk online about hormones, about how women should eat according to their hormones, of how to work out according to your menstrual cycle. I find it super interesting how some people will just shape their lives around this. And we've interviewed a woman on the show who literally structures her life around the phases of her menstrual cycle. So I think it's fascinating. But I've also wondered just how much of it, I guess, is legit, because this isn't something that I've heard about until the past couple of years or so. And, you know, I also just get nervous about misinformation online and, you know, the kind of increasingly scary rhetoric about like hormonal birth control or interrupting your hormone cycles with birth control and whatnot. I don't want to give into that. So I guess I'm wondering, like, how big of a deal are your hormones? And is this kind of like shaping your life around them legit or more of like a wellness fad?
Yeah, I think that's a great question because I'm seeing that as well. I can't open Instagram with and scroll without seeing something about how to optimize and biohack to put, you know, your hormones in the ideal scenario, right? And so what I learned is that everything is so personalized. You know, it really points to you need to have conversations with the people who take care of you about what your hormonal picture looks like because your hormones are doing different things than mine. We're at different life stages. We're also at different points in our cycle. I interviewed a doctor about the whole cycle syncing trend when it comes to workouts because I love exercising. I think my algorithm knows I love to exercise, and so it feeds me a lot of that. And so there was a point at which I got really like, oh my gosh, I'm in this phase of my cycle, and so I shouldn't be doing that heavy strength training workout. And she was like, hold on a second. She's a medical doctor who actually trains elite runners, elite athletes. And she said, there's no real good data right now about timing exercise to the exact moment of your cycle. And she said, you know, what I see, unfortunately, is that a lot of women getting in their heads about it and not doing a workout that makes them feel good, you know? And so what I thought her response was really balanced, which is that if doing a certain type of workout at a certain type of your cycle feels really good and it's inspiring to you and it gets you pushing yourself harder because that's the time of your cycle when you quote unquote should do a hard workout, go for it. But if it's getting in your way, if it's building, if it's putting up barriers to a workout, skip it. And I think that advice applies to all of the different areas, and especially this conversation of biohacking in general. I interviewed a sleep specialist who said all these sleep trackers, they're great if they motivate you to get into bed and do your sleep hygiene before bed. But if they're stressing you out because you can't sleep because you're worried about what your sleep data is going to look like the next morning, that's not beneficial.
Well, personally, I'm also at an age where, I mean, I'm not perimenopausal, but I'm kind of looking to that on the horizon and I'm trying to set myself up well now for my later years. And I guess, from everything that you've looked at, I mean, from bikini medicine to like your heart health and everything from in between, I guess, like, what are some of the best things women can do now in their 30s or 40s to feel good and improve their health in the second half of their lives?
I love this question because what I really heard is that midlife, and let's call it really our 30s, our 40s, even into our 50s, is a real window of opportunity for better health later on. I interviewed doctors who said, if you come to me at age 70 with a list of chronic conditions, they're going to be way harder to treat. It's way better for me as a doctor, these doctors are telling me, to see you at 30 and we can set you on the right path. Right. And I think when it comes to what to do, it really does come back to these lifestyle habits that we hear about a million times that might make some of us kind of roll our eyes and be like, oh, I've heard about it before. But we hear about them a lot because they really do move the needle, right? Exercise being one of them. So I think in our conversation as women about exercise right now, we are really focused on strength training, which is fantastic. I grew up in the generation where in college, I was sweating it out on the elliptical machine while all of my male peers were in the weight room. And if I could go back in time, I would march my way into that weight room and make room for myself and my girlfriends. That said, I think that in our focus on strength training, we don't want to lose sight of the importance of cardio, cardiovascular exercise, as well as balance and a flexibility. These are also really important aspects of exercise that we should be focused on that can really pay off later. I think nutrition, a good anti-inflammatory diet really helps when it comes to all kinds of health outcomes later on and even currently. But for women, I don't know about you, but I can't look anywhere without just getting, the message that I'm not getting enough protein. And so I think while we're focused on getting protein, we also need to make sure that we are eating for enjoyment and getting enough fiber and eating as many fruits and vegetables as we can, not getting too stuck into this whole protein conversation. Sleep is huge too, and I think for women in particular, I interviewed a sleep scientist who said, a lot of her female clients in particular, her female patients say, I just need my time at night after my day is done. She called it revenge bedtime procrastination because it's like, man, don't tell me to go to sleep at 9 o'clock because between the hours of 9 and 11, that's my time. And she said, so get really, and so stay up, do your revenge bedtime procrastination, but get really choosy about what you're watching during that time. So it's less about, screen exposure and more about what you're watching on those screens,
Well, I know this book focuses heavily on the areas outside what you call bikini medicine and reproductive health, but was there anything in that area that surprised you while making this book?
Yes. Well, starting with our anatomy, I had no idea that many of our organs are actually named after men. And there is a new group of anatomists who are trying to change that. So, for example, fallopian tubes. The reason they're called the fallopian tubes is they were named after an old Italian priest whose last name is Fallopio. And so this new group of anatomists, men and women anatomists, and then doctors are trying to say, look, words matter. Let's call these organs, let's not use the eponyms, which are, the names of the organs named after whoever laid claim to them, basically. But let's use anatomical toponyms, for example. So instead of saying fallopian tubes, you say uterine tubes. And what's really cool about this is that actually for medical school students and other healthcare, people studying to become our healthcare providers, it cuts down on cognitive load. So it actually not only is a more progressive way of talking about our bodies, but it helps the people who are learning to take care of us remember these organs. So I thought that was really cool. Yeah, what else surprised me about what we know of as bikini medicine? We talked about breast health, and I think what every woman can do in terms of really taking charge of breast cancer screening. I think when it comes to menstrual health, a lot of us don't get a really good lesson as to what's normal and what's not when it comes to our cycle. And I think for a lot of women, we can power through symptoms. Again, it's like I've got this. I'll speak personally here. I did for years. I had very heavy periods. They were very regular, and so I focused on the upside of that. Look at me. It's every 28 days I get my cycle. But unfortunately, I didn't talk about the fact that the first 2 to 3 days were like crime scene periods. And I finally learned more about the menstrual cycle throughout the course of writing this book, brought it up to my gynecologist who said, let's look at this. Sure enough, I had a uterus full of fibroids. When I look back, I think, gosh, had I known more about the ins and the outs of the menstrual cycle, I think years ago I would have brought up my symptoms with a healthcare provider and had this issue looked at before it got so far. And so I share that to really empower women that, we really need to take matters into our own hands sometimes, educate ourselves to then be able to be proactive, and get the care we need.
Wow. If it's not too much to ask, I just don't know much about fibroids. I guess, what exactly are they and what are your treatment options for them?
Fibroids are really common, and there's a lot of different options. I did a big section in my book about this because they're so common. And as Dr. Lauren Stryker told me when I interviewed her, she's written like the book on fibroids and hysterectomy. So she said with fibroids, it's like an a la carte situation. She was joking about it. But when it comes to surgeries or treatments, you have a lot of different options. There's medications, there's different procedures you can do to treat fibroids. In my case, the only option was a hysterectomy, because I had so many in so many different areas. So if you have, and when I got the diagnosis of fibroids, I was devastated. It felt like my body had betrayed me. Like here I am, I was 40 years old at the time, just like, wow, like I can't believe I've gone so long without noticing this in a bigger way. And so I think for anyone struggling with fibroids, it's just they're really common. It's really and there are treatments, multiple different types.
Well, Megan, thanks so much for taking the time. I guess, what do you hope readers most take away from this book?
Yeah, so I really want readers to feel confident talking about their health. And I think that starts with education. I think as all of us can relate to when we have the information we need and the language we need to talk about health, that's when we feel confident. That's when we can sit in a doctor's office with that power differential, in that flimsy gown, feeling like, wait a second, I know that you know bodies and I know my body. And here's what's happening for me. So that's my biggest hope is that women can pick up my book and tuck in and out of chapters that feel really important to them, whatever life stage they're in, to say, what do I need to know to have that great interaction with my doctor? I think we toss around the phrase knowledge is power, which is true, right? But I really feel like knowledge is empowerment. It helps us feel empowered to speak up for ourselves. And that's at a time when women's health is feels like it's under attack. I think this is more important than ever.
Megan Rabbit is an award-winning health journalist and the author of The New Rules of Women's Health, Your Guide to Thriving at Every Age. It's out now through The Open Field. You can learn more about the book and Megan's work at newrulesofwomenshealth.com. Megan, thanks again.
I've loved it. Thank you so much. Really great questions. And I think we have to keep talking about these things.
Switching gears before we go, New York's child poverty rate has consistently been one of the worst in the nation for years now. Currently, the state ranks 41st in the U.S., with 18% of children living in poverty. Amy Feierisel of the New York Public News Network brings us more.
New York's child poverty rate is bad. Kari Siddiqui is with the Schuyler Center and coordinates the New York Can End Child Poverty Coalition.
18% of kids across New York State are living in poverty.
In many upstate cities like Syracuse, Binghamton, and Rochester, the number of children living in poverty is upwards of 40%. To try to change that, the state legislature passed the Child Poverty Reduction Act in 2021. Its goal was to cut New York's child poverty rate in half over a decade. Unfortunately, 5 years in, not much has changed, says Siddiqui.
So we're now about halfway towards that goal, and we really haven't seen the rate of child poverty reduce yet. However, we have made some pretty significant investments.
One of the biggest policy changes to come from the Reduction Act is only just now taking effect. That's the expansion of New York's child tax credit. Starting on January 1st, that credit increased from $330 to $1,000 per child under the age of four. Next year, the amount will increase for children aged 4 to 17.
And so this is a really significant investment and is estimated to reduce child poverty by about 9%. Despite that, though, we still have a really long way to go to reach that goal.
Another marker that child poverty advocates pay close attention to is food insecurity rates. Siddiqui says that's a clear indicator of financial strain on families. And those also look quite grim in New York right now.
1 in 5 children around New York State experience food insecurity, which means that they did not have adequate access to food sometimes or often.
Now, there is some potential relief coming from the child care front. If New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani and Governor Kathy Hochul get their way, New York is on the verge of embarking on an incredibly ambitious child care expansion. Besides rent, child care is typically a family's largest expense. Hochul and Mamdani hope making child care more accessible and affordable will bring relief to families and the overall economy. But those policies will take time to put into place. Siddiqui has concerns about how federal cuts could make things worse in the state before they get better. For example, cuts to the nation's largest anti-hunger program, SNAP, formerly known as food stamps.
H.R. 1, the federal bill, made some really significant changes to SNAP, which will result in more families and children experiencing food insecurity, almost certainly.
Last fall, the federal government also announced it was discontinuing the USDA's annual food security report, calling it, quote, redundant, costly, and extraneous. Siddiqui says that report has long been a critical tracking tool.
And this is worrisome as it is a loss of our ability to measure the problem, which then results in making it a lot more difficult for us to address those problems.
Governor Hochul has signaled in her recent budget proposal that the state does intend to fill some of the gaps left behind by federal cuts. Siddiqui says the issue of child poverty will need that help if New York has any hope of reducing its rate by 2031. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Amy Feierisel.
Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night, bed on the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool. Sweet bells in little girl dreams. They said, oh, I want a big life, not a house that could have been like. Where are you taking?